Good evening. I hope you can hear me. Can you hear me? Let me know. Give me a thumbs
yes.
up. Well, no. All right, you can hear me. Excellent. Okay, very good. All right, so then let us begin. Tonight, we are in a second part of a series, from what I understand, called Israel at 75, as we are excited to celebrate Israel's 75th birthday. There is a three-part winter series, the halachic questions that brought us to today. And the mandate I was given was to discuss a particular halachic shaila, one which had repercussions into the shaping of the modern state of Israel, or was it something that really needed to be determined and adjudicated in order for our state of Israel to flourish. And therefore, tonight we're going to discuss the question of the status of a Chiloni Jew. What is the status of a Chiloni Jew? So that's what we're doing tonight. Before I begin, are there any questions, comments? Let me know. Am I clear? Okay, I assume I am. If I'm not, well, I guess I'll be talking to myself. Okay, and for those who don't know who I am Yossi Katz. I was in the Kollel for 2 years. My wife is Emma, more importantly. She is still in the Kollel, and that's how I got here today. Fine, so that's where we're. The question of a Chiloni Jew, it's a very important question, one that needed to be addressed, and I want to explain to you why. For most of history, there was no such thing as a secular Jew. We came from what we'd call a traditional community where everyone did what their parents did, and there wasn't really an option to veer from it, to go elsewhere. In the Middle Ages especially, the rulers required of all the citizens of a country to have allegiance to some religion. So either it was Catholicism, Protestantism, or Judaism. And there was no such thing even as a secular identity. Either you were a member of the church, you were a member of whatever subgroup that the nation recognized, in our case, a Jew, which meant that there was no choice but to be Jewish or to apostatize, which you can imagine to not to only renounce your Judaism, then to embrace Christianity. Definitely, it was definitely done, but that was a huge undertaking and a huge step. What happens is, as we get into the modern era, and again, I'm just want to set the stage here for why we even have this question and how it took so long, why it took so long for the rabbis to grapple with this question. As we enter into the modern era, a couple of things happen. One is the idea of a secular identity and a whole in the world becomes something that's a possibility where no longer the nations require someone to have allegiance to a church or to any sort of religious body, and you can just live your secular life. So that's number one. And we start finding just in general society, especially as the Enlightenment begins and people start moving towards a more scientific viewpoint of the world, religion, therefore, I'm not going to say it's relegated, it's still a very strong force, but religion becomes only one of multiple options. We find also that some of these countries as well would went so far as to strip any sort of traditional authority that the religious communities wielded. That for many years, while yes, we paid taxes and we were under the rulership of whatever host country we were in, but we had a semi-autonomous existence. We had our bezdin, we had our methods of punishing those who deviated, whether it was actual punitive measures such as malchus, whipping, lashes, or it was some sort of social coercion. That was something that was done. But as the modernity progresses, we start finding that countries strip the bezdin and strip these communities of their autonomy, of their ability, therefore, and their authority, therefore, to punish and to use coercion as a method of keeping people within the traditional framework, as well as you can imagine that social coercion only works, such as putting someone in chayiv and saying you can't get an aliyah, you can't be buried in the cemetery, you can't marry, whatever it may be. That only works so long as someone cares enough to be part of the society. If someone's leaving and there's enough people who have also left, so then they have where to go. What happens, therefore, is you start finding people are leaving traditional, I'm going to say orthodoxy, that's an anachronism, much later term. People start leaving in droves. And you have an entire communities now of people who we call secular Jews, who have, they're not Christian, they don't believe in anything, although it's more of they don't believe, perhaps, in the Torah of Sinai. They don't believe in certain aspects of what traditionally was believed, and they embrace a more secular, free lifestyle, engaging in what we, I guess, call as sinning, eating non-kosher, not being punctilious in their observance of Shabbos, etc. So this is what starts happening. And it then becomes the charge of the rabbis to confront this new phenomenon of a secular Jew. Because if you were to look at the traditional sources, if you look at the Gemara, the quintessential Jew who was secular, or not Jew, or who left religious life, was someone who was a mumalach, was someone who was mechalal Shabbos for Hesia. Someone didn't keep the Shabbos. That was their way of essentially saying, I'm renouncing faith, and therefore the Gemara equates someone who's mechalal Shabbos, as what we would say is someone who's just secular. The Gemara says is kumumar b'chol haTorah kulam. They have a status of a mumar, mumar being an apostate. They are in the Chal Shabbos. They're basically in Ovdei Avodah Zarah. They're worshiping idols. And what happens then is this is not just semantics and opprobrium that we're saying, oh, they're Mechal Shabbos, they're a mumar. Mechal Shabbos, they're a heretic. That's not what's happening here. Because the way in which the Gemara, and if you go through the Rishonim, view heretics and view someone who's not Jewish, put it that way, an Akum, an idolater, is that Chazal enact a whole host of practices that are meant to counter any sort of assimilation and intermingling. We don't trust their food, their kashrus. We don't even trust if they shech. We say we don't trust your shechita. Their wine becomes yayin nesef, wine that was poured by an idolater, or at the very least stam yenim. Again, we're forbidden to partake in their wine. They have no nemanis. They can't come to Bezdin and testify that I saw so and so do something, or I know so and so. Oh, so I know someone else money, because once we establish there, like an Akman, Obedin Chavim, so then someone who's just Mechal Shabbos, they keep kosher, they keep all the other mitzvot, but we say, Dino Ka'akum, you're like a non-idolater, and therefore all of these fences that were instituted now kick in. And it's interesting, by the way, or not interesting, I think it's important to recognize, well, what happens now when it's not just one deviant person, but it becomes society en masse. And suddenly it's not, oh, I know a guy who left, make sure not to do business with him, but it's my brother, it's my sister, it's my son, it's my nephew. It becomes, when it's pervasive, everyone is dealing with this, it becomes a lot harder to now start enacting these regulations, especially when you still are living together to some extent. And also, I think this is important, is part of, as I noted, part of these measures that were put in place by Chazal in order to create some sort of barrier between the affiliated or the traditional and those who apostatized was in order to prevent intermingling, which could then lead to a further apostasy among others. Part of it was punitive, as if to say, realize you can't just walk in and out the door. It's not a revolving door. Once you go out, you are actually bringing upon yourself a whole new status, and therefore we're going to treat you differently. It's not a free for all. In fact, you actually find this, that among the Rishonim, you find this, we're familiar with the term Yisrael, Af Kishafat Yisrael Have. I don't know if you're familiar with the term. Basically, it means once a Jew, always a Jew. The Gemara quotes this in Sanhedrin, and Rashi quotes this as well. The assumption of once you're a Jew, always a Jew. However, we start finding in the Rishonim, and Professor Kanefogel, Ephraim Kanefogel, recently authored a book on this, where he says that this notion of once a Jew, always a Jew, is not necessarily something that's held by all the Rishonim. There is some sort of sentiment that there is a way to renounce your Judaism, almost to say that now you're Dino Ka'akam and we treat you like that. And then we even find, I believe there are multiple quotes, that there are these elaborate tshuvas that were prescribed to people who wanted to return from their apostasy. That they had to go to the mikvah, similar to someone who's converting. A ger goes to a mikvah, that they require, some of them require to get lashes and engage in other sorts of ways of penitence to show that you're not just coming back, but you're actually going through a new transformation, re-entering the Jewish people. So this is really to frame it, this is what we're dealing with. On the one hand, we have an entire society, tens of people, your brother, your neighbor, your nephew, who have apostatized, or in this case, who have left the traditional community. And the other hand, our tradition seems to be telling us, if you are secular, Dino Ka'akum, we can't collaborate with you. We can't cooperate with you. We can't eat together because your food is treif. You can't touch your wine. The wine is treif, effectively. We can't even have a court system together because we don't believe you. We don't trust you. You lose your nemunas. And if that's true, if that's true, so then how are we going to grapple with secular people that are now imams? And that brings us to where we are now. Tonight, we're discussing the halacha questions that brought us to today when it comes to Israel. You can imagine how much this question was heightened in because of the broader implications of it's not just a brother, a mother, a sister, or whatever it may be, but now we are creating a country, the state of Israel, which is A, being brought about by secularists, even militant secularists. And that's a question, again, you find in the polemics of the anti-Zionists of how can anything good come for the fact that you have these Kofrim, these Apikarsim, these heretics who are establishing the state of Israel. They're not going to be God's messengers. They are Dino Ka'akim, as we said. They're like Avodizara, worshiping idols. So you find, again, there's a discussion on that end. But we also, just from a practical perspective, if we're going to treat those who are not members of the traditional community, the quote-unquote Chilonim, as an Akim, so how are we going to create a functioning society? The trust is not going to be there when we can't eat together. Again, we see that there's this heightened urgency when it comes to trying to build an economy and build a country and defend the country if half the population is looking at the other half and saying, you're not Jewish. You're Kailo, not Jewish. So that's why the question really had to be determined when we got to the state of Israel. So that's just to set the stage. One more note, and then we'll be informal. I want to tell you what we're not discussing tonight. What we're not going to discuss is the approach, especially in the state of Israel, to other religious denominations, such as conservative and reform. We're discussing just our approach, or the approach that the halachists needed to grapple with, and they did grapple with, when it comes to trying to reevaluate how we can live and coexist and collaborate with the secular Jew. That's, we're talking about the individuals, not the collective, because when it comes to the collective, it's a whole other host of issues. First of all, early state of Israel, they weren't really dealing with conservative and reform the same way. It was only after 67, after the great miracle, the Six-Day War, where there was this great awakening among the diaspora, and you start finding that the conservative reform movement really wanted to gain a foothold in Israel, because again, they reawoke, not a bad thing, but it reawakened in many people a sense of Jewish identity and Jewish pride. And it's only then when they come, but again, that brings on a whole host of issues, which we are literally, for those following Israeli news, this is what's being grappled with at this moment in the Knesset. We have a Knesset, which is the most quote-unquote right-wing Knesset ever, most religious, if you will, ever. I'll let you to define the term religion. I didn't say Jewish, not taking a political stand here. And they're trying to figure out, very much pushing an agenda of removing the reform and the conservative from any sort of power. With, again, what the tension there is that once you allow conservative reform, gayrus and conversions and gittin, and that's not recognized by the Orthodox, and then what happens in 50 years? You have two Klal Yisraels, where half of Klal Yisraels, the other half sees you're illegitimate, you're mamzerim, you're whatever other, you're not really Jewish. So that's what's happening in Israel. But I don't want to discuss this. It's a hot topic. It's a great topic to discuss. I mean, it's sad, but it's something that has to be discussed, but it's not for tonight. Tonight, I want to discuss, again, how we approach the individual. And the reason why this is something that really comes to the fore in, I'll say, 48, just to give a date, but it happens a little prior to that, the dawn of modernity, breakdown of the traditional framework of communities, is because that's only then when the walls of the ghetto come down and Jews start to assimilate and acculturate, you start finding a full society, not just individual, rogue individual, but society of people who are now becoming and identifying as secular, not keeping the halacha in the way in which it was communally practiced, not believing necessarily in the things that one has to believe, and that now we have to grapple with that. So what I want to do now is look at three different approaches, and not just three different approaches, but actually see how this discussion and this conversation evolved, and the way in which the orientation towards the Chiloni evolves from the onset, I would say, of modernity or the early period, even pre-state in Germany, and then see how it started to play out within the state of Israel, and really get to even the modern day, how Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, how they saw and their thinking on the whole issue evolves to bring us to the next frontier, next plane. So that's what we're doing. Three different, I want to look at the evolution over the last 200 years or so of the approach to the Chiloni Jew. Any questions before I begin? Okay, fine. So one of the first people to really deal with this, and again, I say the first, it was, there are others who said what we're about to discuss, and I think it's just most famous, it was most famously put by the Binyon Siyam, The Shalos do with Binyan Tzion. That was Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, if you have never heard of him, you've certainly heard of one of his prime Talmidim. And just by hearing who his Talmud was, who his student was, it'll probably give you a good view and vantage point of who Rav Yaakov Ettlinger was and what his Hashkafa was, what his worldview was. So Rav Yaakov Ettlinger was a German rabbi. One of his prime students was Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch. That him we, him I hope we've heard of. Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch, Torah Derech Eretz, one could make an argument that precursor to Yeshiva University, to modern Orthodoxy in America, really stemmed from Rav Hirsch and his approach to modernity, his approach to tradition, his approach to confronting a lot of these issues. I don't want to, I know there's a lot of academic debate, maybe too much, about how much is a bridge and how similar and dissimilar they are. Not for me. The point is, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger is the Rebbe of Rav Hirsch. He authored the Shilas and Shuvas Binyan Tzion. Binyan Tzion literally means the building of Zion. Why is it called that? So it's very fascinating. His first three shuvas, have to deal with, is one allowed to go to Har HaBayis, if that became a possibility then, and bring sacrifices, even though there's no temple. And I believe his fourth tshuva is actually tshuva written to New York. There's someone, a case that, a wild case that took place in New York. So again, you see again, 1800s, but he's well-regarded, well-renowned, getting questions from Jerusalem, getting questions from New York. He also authored a book, a series of svarim on the Gemara called the Aruch Luner. It's an important work because, and I don't want to get, I know someone might call me out for this, but I would venture to say that he was one of the last German rabbin who authored a book on the Gemara, which won universal acclaim. You walk into any base medrash in the world, or almost any base medrash that has a decent library, and you'll find the Aruch Luner. You won't find, you know, you'll find whatever you find. You'll find the Rambam, the Rashba, the Ritva. You'll find some Achronim, like Bnei Yeshua or Joshua Falk, and you'll find the Aruch Luner. So he has really, he's not, the reason I'm giving you this background is like, A, I think it's interesting, but also this is not just some random German rabbi who no one's ever heard of. Any base medrash in the world. Now, I'll tell you, when I was in Karen Biyat, the Beis Medrash, they have a well-regarded Otzer, a library, which is in a building adjacent to the actual Beis Medrash. In the Beis Medrash themselves, they stock with the svarim that are more commonly used. There's an Aruch Luner. You walk into, and again, this is more circumstantial, but you walk into most Beis Medrashes, there's an Aruch Luner. So we're talking about someone who really, I prepared this year today. I live in Linden. Linden has a bunch of Hasidish shoals. I'm not Hasidish, but I am the only non-Hasidish rabbi in town. I was preparing this actually of all places in the Satmar Shul, but in the Satmar Shul today, and they have an Aruch Luner. It's there. It's everywhere. So the Aruch Luner makes the following observation. It's a very important observation. He looks around and he sees that there are so many Jewish people, his brothers and sisters, who are no longer observing, who are no longer identifying with the traditional way of life. They're secular Jews. They're maskilim. They join the Haskalah, they join the Enlightenment, and that's who they are. And if you look in the classical sources, as we noted, that means that they're dino ka'akum, we write them off, we don't trust their kashrus, their wine becomes yayin nesef, et cetera, et cetera. And he says, let's take a break from it. Why is it that someone who's mechalal Shabbos, who violates Shabbos, is dino ka'akum? We treat them like an adult. What exactly is it about chilul Shabbos that we equate them to an idolater and therefore we give them, or we give them the status of someone who's an idolater with all of those? There are many mitzvahs in the Torah. We don't say someone who doesn't shake lulav is dino ka'akum. We don't say someone who doesn't blow shofar is dino ka'akum. There's something specific about Shabbos. And this is what he says. He says, the best place to even quote is, we say in Kiddush, we say, "V'Shabbos katshu be'av v'ratzim filanu zikaron l'maseh bereishis." What's Shabbos? Shabbos is a zikaron l'maseh bereishis. It's about a once a week, every 7 days, we come back to this place where we remember that, and almost in a sense of renewal, the sense that God created this world and God is involved in this world. That Shabbos isn't just a day where we rest. Shabbos isn't just a day where we don't do malachas and we make kiddush, but it's through following the laws of Shabbos, to fulfilling the mitzvot of Shabbos, we are essentially agreeing once again to the fact that God runs the world and God created the world. The world didn't always exist. The world didn't come into existence from nowhere, but rather it was part of the intelligent design, the will of God. So Shabbos, therefore, is not just another mitzvah, which again, not knocking mitzvah, it's very important, but Shabbos actually is the foundational mitzvah, because it's through that we are acknowledging and acquiescing to God and God's presence in this world. And that's why we say Dino ka Akum. What's an Akum? You say Akum, I keep saying non-Jew, but Akum literally means Ovid Kachavim. It's an abbreviation for Ovid Kachavim, someone who serves stars, as in an idolater. If you are rejecting Shabbos, it's not just you're rejecting 39 malachas and all the subcategories, but what you're doing is you're saying, I don't believe God exists who created the world. I don't believe any of that. I'm an idolater. Says the Aruch HaNer, now you can understand why we treat someone who's Mechalel Shabbos with such severity, where we say, you're Dino Ka'akum, we're not going to eat with you. We're not going to, again, your wine becomes Yayin Nesach, and you don't trust your Shechita, etc. Dino Ka'akum. The Aruch HaNer says, when I look around, in Germany, I don't see people who are renouncing God because they're not keeping Shabbos. This is not the way of abrogating their commitment to God, because they just want to enjoy themselves and violate one of the strictures of Shabbos. He says, I see people who are going to shul Friday night. They're going to shul in the morning. Think of in America, the Ashkenazi meeting, which initially started so people can go to work. And then after they make Kiddush, they're going out and they're violating the Shabbos. He says, and therefore, it's not that they're repudiating God. They're just violating Shabbos because for them, Shabbos isn't as important, or they have other reasons or other motivations. Nothing to do with the fact that they want to stand up there and say to God, I don't believe it. And it's with this distinction, what the Aruch HaNer does is he creates a space, or better yet, he neutralizes the severity of one who's Mechalel Shabbos. Now, obviously, it's a terrible thing, and we believe everyone should keep Shabbos, and it pains us people don't keep Shabbos. But he neutralizes, I would say, the consequence of one who is Mechalel Shabbos by saying, you know what, don't do it, it's terrible, and we still have all the punishments, etc., but we're not going to say you're not, because you're not. You clearly believe in God. You're still going to show, you're making Kiddush, you're singing Zmiros, whatever it may be. It's just, you have other taivas. Moshe has a tshuva in Igros Moshe where someone says that they keep their business open on Shabbos, but and they want to know if they're allowed to duchen, bless the congregation on the holidays. And Rav Henkin has a very similar tshuva. And they also come to a similar conclusion, again, based on the Aruch HaNer, that why is this person keeping the store open? He says it's a taivas moment. He wants more money, or he needed the money, whatever it may be. It's not because he's Mechalel Shabbos Behesia. What's Mechalel Shabbos Behesia? Literally means someone who violates a Shabbos in public, because that's not what it means. It's literally means that it means someone who violates a Shabbos in a way in which they're essentially saying, I don't care. They're violating because they're trying to make a point. It's like they used to be in the shtetl. Apparently, the way in which you showed you're no longer a Shomer Shabbos, no longer part of the traditional community, is you'd smoke a cigarette on Shabbos and Yom Kippur. So you can stay to everyone making a pronouncement, I'm not a Shabbos keeper. I have nothing to do with this. Well, says Moshe, if you're keeping your store open because you need the money to live, and therefore you have the Taivas Mama, if you're violating Shabbos not because of one of these other reasons, he says that's considered Mechal Shabbos sin. You're doing it privately. Because again, he reads privately, probably not as because if there's a people who know or not, but rather are you trying to make a point or not trying to make a point. The Aruch HaNer, and that's stemming from the Aruch HaNer, who makes this distinction, who neutralizes the severity of the consequences by saying, look, at the end of the day, here are these people, they're good Jews. They're simple Jews, maybe. Perhaps their parents weren't even the ones who left. It was their grandparents, like Karl Marx. Karl Marx, we always say he was Jewish. I believe that his grandparents were the ones who walked away from the traditional lifestyle. Not even his parents. So you have all these people now who grow up in an environment where they don't know better. And therefore he says they are Dino Ketinok Shenishba, like a child taken captive, quoting the Gemara and the Rambam, explains that if you have a child who's taken into captivity when they're young, they don't grow up within the framework of Jewish education and family, you can't blame them for not keeping Shabbos, not keeping mitzvos, and therefore they too don't have the severity of the consequences as one who violates Shabbos. Says the Aruch HaNer, the same here as well. Someone who believes in God, who's not saying, this is not a zikron lamas gracious, it's not a remembrance gracious, rather saying, look, I have taivas, I want to enjoy myself. So then that sort of person is not Dino Ka'akum, and rather just what you call a secular Jew. Now, it's important to note a couple things. One is that, therefore, if someone really did believe, in the secularism, in that God doesn't exist, was an atheist, so the Binyan Sion is not covered. That's number one. Number two is that, more, this is not a side note, the next point is that I think historically, this is actually borne out. The Minyan Sion's analysis is actually correct. There is a wonderful historian on the skull in general. His name is Shmuel Feiner. He's in Hebrew U. You can check it up. I believe he's in Hebrew U. He wrote an amazing biography on Moses Mendelssohn. Was one of the Yale University Jewish Lives, which is a series they have, Jewish Lives. I believe next week or the following week, they're having one come out on Elie Wiesel. So they have many, many Jewish characters throughout the ages. Shmuel Feiner wrote on Moses Mendelssohn. His area is in like, and he makes a very similar point from a historical observation, which really aligns with the Binyan Sion, that many people who are joining the secularists and joining the Haskalah, the Enlightenment, they're not doing it because they're trying to reject God. So he has an article. I don't remember where the article was published. The article is called The Pseudo-Enlightenment. And he opens the article up with I went to look for it. I couldn't find it. I read it a number of years ago. He opens it up with, I remember if it was a letter or a diary entry from someone who writes about these enlightened people. And he writes about them in this polemic way. But here are these people who are engaging in licentiousness, debauchery, just want the freedoms of not being constricted by religion and halacha. And that's the only reason they're doing this. And they're not sincere. And this person's going on and on. About again, like these people, these low lives who just want to enjoy themselves, and that's why they're part of the Haskalah. And the letter is signed. You would expect it was signed the way it's written. It's expected to be signed by someone, I don't know, from the Chassam Sofer's camp, one of the opponents of the Reform movement, someone who really, you know, Rabbi Abraham Schlesinger, one of the Talmidim of the Chassam Sofer, who was a vehement opponent to Reform, who wrote in very polemical and severe ways. He's probably the one who wrote about how disgusting these enlightened, quote-unquote enlightened Jews are. They think they're enlightened, but really they're just low lives and people engaging in licentiousness. However, it's not signed. It's actually signed by someone who was themselves an enlightened person, by someone who had left the traditional community, who had become a maskil, someone, an enlightened person. And the point the person is making, and I think it's also rather intuitive, is that for the most part, most people are not joining movements because of some ideological pressing motivation. They're joining movements because that's just what appeals to them at the time. That they see here's a movement where that rejects Torah, Mishnah, rejects Halakha, and therefore the vast majority see this as an opportunity to kind of jump on and live the life without the constraints of the traditional lifestyle. And so this person is very upset. He's like, you guys are giving me a bad rep. Like, I'm a real Musk. I'm a real Kofi. What are you guys doing? It reminds me of this old Yiddish story. There was a small town Kofi, small town heretic, lived out in the villages. You can name the place in Europe. And he decided that he wanted to really become a real heretic. He wanted to really do it right. So how do you become a real heretic? He said, I'm going to go to the big city and find the biggest heretic there. And I'm going to see how he lives his life. Better yet, I'll go there for Shabbos. See how the way he lives Shabbos and desecrates Shabbos, I will know that's how I can be the best heretic I can be. So he hitches up his wagon. He goes to this big town heretic, big kofer for Shabbos. And the little kofer goes to the big kofer with excitement and anticipation that he's going to learn how to be a real kofer. He gets there Friday night and he's surprised that they have a Shabbos table set. They sit around the table. And big time heretic picks up his cup of wine with tremendous kavana, goes Yoy Mashishi Vayichu Hashemayim V'Aretz B'Chol Tzivam. And little town heretic is a little perplexed, confused. What's going on? Okay, he comes to the meal. He's like, probably the meal. That's where they're going to discuss the heresy. Some people discuss politics. He's going to discuss heresy. No, Divrei Torah, singing songs called Mikadeshivi. Okay, he says maybe Friday night he wants to keep. We'll see tomorrow lunch. That's where I'll come out. Comes to the lunch table and big town heretic goes, Mishamru, Bnei Yisrael, Shabbos, a regular Shabbos meal. So now little town heretic is rather confused, or more than confused. He's totally befuddled. Like, what's going on here? Why is big town heretic? Where's the heresy? Okay, Shalashuddis. But that Shalashuddis is the Shalashuddis that make the Hasidim look like they didn't know how to do Shalashuddis. and then dragged out and prolonged in every single version of Yidden Nefesh. They sing Mizmor David 15 times for Parnassah and Atzlacha and Gesund and everything else. Because, okay, maybe it's Havdalah. And then there's the Havdalah, as you can imagine, that makes NCSY look like they don't know how to do Havdalah. And they're sitting around the table now after Havdalah. The little town heretic, he can't contain himself anymore. He's frustrated. He's confused. He's like, big town heretic, I don't get it. You're supposed to be the one, the heretic, the kofer. I little kofer, came to you, big kofer. And I'm sitting here, and Shabbos is regular. It's a regular halachic Jewish spiritual experience. To which the big town heretic looks, the little big town kofer looks at little kofer and says, let me tell you something, little kofer. The difference between me and you is that I'm a kofer, you're a sheikis. I'm a heretic, you're just a bum. This is kind of the message that's emerging from this article of Pseudo Enlightenment. Whereas you have these people who are the enlightened people who Beshitta, this is what they believed in, that the Torah wasn't the Sinai or whatever else other issues they had. And therefore they're walking away from religion and traditional life. And they're frustrated with all the bums, quote unquote, the shkutz, the shegetzes, who just see this as an opportunity to renounce halacha so they can enjoy themselves. And I think when I read that, I realized that's what the Binyan Sina is saying. That for the vast majority of these quote-unquote secular Jews, these vast majority of these non-traditional Jews, better way of putting it, it's not that they're renouncing God. They're just kind of jumping. They're jumping at the opportunity to, because they were never inspired or whatever it may be, whatever reason it is, so they're jumping at that opportunity to enjoy themselves. And that's the position of the Binyan Sina. Again, the Binyan Sina says, the reason why Machal Shabbos is someone, is Dino Ka'akwi, treat like someone who worships idols, an idolater, is because they're through Shabbos, when we reaffirm our commitment to God and the fact that and reaffirm our belief that God created the world, and now they're effectively saying, I don't believe in that. And says it being seen, well, look around. Most people are pseudo-enlightened people. They're just jumping at the opportunity. Okay, now let's fast forward a few years till we get to the state of Israel. And we have a character, an individual called the Chaz Nish, Rabbi Yeshua Ishaya Karelitz, someone who I'm sure if you've heard any halacha, sure you've heard of him. In any shir in halacha, almost invariably, is going to either quote the Chaz Nish or Moshe Feinstein or both of them. I'm talking about a major, major thing. You know, in the last, when it comes to halacha, in the last 100 years, if you were to name the three top halachists in the last 100 years, again, probably leave someone out, but I'd say the Mishnah Berurah, as in found in every base medrash. Rav Moshe Feinstein found in every base medrash. The Chaz Nish. We're talking about it. He's a major figure. He's the founder. B'nai Brak was founded around. So you think of B'nai Brak, that city in Israel, which is known for its Torah learning and known for the more Haredi approach to life. It all stemmed from the Chaz Nish. Chaim Kanievsky's yard site this week was a nephew. And he lived his life trying to emulate and the Chaz Nish. Again, I'm trying to say this to stress a major, 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 major figure in halachic life and in religious life. He was a interesting person in the sense that he was an autodidact. He never learned in yeshiva, or learned for a very short time, and he never had any institutional affiliation. He sat and learned by himself. And even when he came to Israel, which is its own interesting story, you know, he was already a little renowned for his scholarship. He published his svarim already, and Rav Kook is the one who tried to secure him a position. Rav Kook actually encouraged others to buy his svarim just to give him a livelihood. So the Chaz Nish comes to Israel, and even then he never had an official position, but his influence, he had an outsized influence on Israeli society, especially the Haredi population, and by dint of that, on the broader population, so much so that in Maariv, the secular Israeli paper, there was the headline, big bold lettering one day, was Ben-Gurion goes to meet the Chaz Nish, because that's in fact what happened. Ben-Gurion realized that he was trying to pass certain laws in terms of the geus, the draft, drafting women, drafting Torah scholars, that the way in which he can have some way to speak to the Haredi community was to go to the Chaz Nish, who he was. Ben-Gurion walks away from that meeting and he writes in his diary something along the effects of, I met, it's astounding that this saintly man wields such an influence on society. Now, no institutional affiliation. That meeting in and of itself, by the way, which we'll turn to in a few moments, it happened about 70 years ago, 71 years ago. There was a tremendous amount of mystique and mystery about what actually took place in that meeting. And both sides have spawned their own mythology about what exactly took place. The Chaz Nish say this, the Chaz Nish say that. Lots of sayings. There were only three people in the room or four people in the room back then, the Chaz Nish and his Gabbai, Ben-Gurion and the future president of Israel, Chaim Nivon. Again, we'll get back to that in a minute. So this is this meeting that takes place. That's, again, just to highlight who the Chazanish was in terms of his influence in society and in crafting the Haredi narrative in the state of Israel. The Chazanish has to deal now with this question. Again, it's much more pressing. Now it's not just like I have a brother, but it's on a national scale. How are we going to collaborate and cooperate when it comes to everything from just the financial sector to government sector to running an effective country? And he says two things. He says there's two questions we have to deal with. Question number one is what we've been saying the whole time, the status of a mumer, the status of a kofer, the status of someone who's mechalal Shabbos, right? Mechalal Shabbos, a beautiful mumer, kofer, etc. And where the Rambam points out that someone who's mechalal Shabbos, someone who's a kofer, who's a heretic, if they were to be on the bottom of a pit, we don't have to help them come out of the pit, as if to say there is no fraternity with someone who, we don't have a shared fraternity with someone who does not believe in the Torah and does not follow the halacha. We're not brothers. We don't have the same. The Torah says brothers. The Torah means those who are among us who keep the Torah, mitzvahs, and believe in what we believe. So the Chazanish has to contend with this whole sentiment, which we've been discussing, and therefore with all therefore the implications. And the Chazanish also deals with a second question, one which I think is important to bring up, and that is, even if we can somehow finagle our way, or I don't use that word because it sounds like it's a heck. I think the Binyan Siyan really put it strongly. It wasn't just him. A lot of the major poskim discuss it then. But even if once we deal with that, there's still a second principle which we have to talk about, and that is the mitzvah of tochach, of rebuke. We have to rebuke our fellow who what we see is sinning. So how are we going to deal with that? Yes, maybe I can say I'm not going to treat you like, you know, your wine is yayin nesef, forbidden wine, but I'm still going to sit there rebuking. By the way, that's where perhaps one can make an argument, and there is, this argument is made, whether effective or not. Yashiv has a tshuva on this, and Sternbach has a tshuva on this, where the whole idea of a hafkanah, a protest chil Shabbos, what they're doing is they're saying, we're rebuking you. Then again, as we'll see in a minute, if the point of rebuke is, it's a very goal-oriented mitzvah. It's not just to rebuke you, but to rebuke you so that you return. Well, we can argue it's counterproductive to publicly protest. Although they may argue, and this is not taking me a little bit of field, so I'll end with this point, that there may be two elements to rebuke. There may be the element of rebuke so that you return, but also the idea that we rebuke not for you, but to make a statement as a community so that those who live among us know what's unacceptable. But that's beyond what I want to get into now. The point I want to talk about is Chazanish is two ways he has to contend with A, the status of Mumar, how can we leave them bottom of a pit? And number two, the idea of rebuke. And this is what the Chazanish says. What does it mean to become a heretic, to become a kofer? Says the Chazanish, it's not just a choice to make that I say I want to embrace a certain lifestyle, one of secularism, one of not of a non-halachic lifestyle. It's not just a choice I'm making, but it also has to be a negation or a rejection of where I'm coming from. Meaning to say as follows, to be a heretic, to believe in heresy doesn't make you a heretic. It makes you mistaken. To be a heretic, you not only have to believe in heresy, heresy can mean I don't believe that the halacha is binding, but you also have to renounce and reject Hashem and Torah. It's twofold, which means someone who grows up, who never knew about Torah or mitzvahs, they're not rejecting God. They're not rejecting halacha. They're not rejecting Shulchan Aruch by saying I'm doing whatever I feel like I'm doing, engaging in this lifestyle. All they're doing is embracing a lifestyle which seems to make the most sense to them, is intuitive to them, and is what they feel fits with their own moral compass, which could be a wonderful thing. They're not rejecting anything. And therefore, says the Chazanish, we talk about kofer, someone who no longer is within the fraternal brotherhood that we share, someone who is dino ka'ak, who we have to say their wine is us, and we don't trust, well, their wine is us. Let's leave it at that one for now. It's not just because they embraced a lifestyle, but also because they rejected a lifestyle. And this is the crucial point. It says the Chazanish, in the era that we live, in the epoch that we live, and I almost stress in the millennia that we live, where there's no overt manifestation of divine providence, where God's hand is not clearly seen in our lives, then one cannot be a heretic because you can't really reject God. It's a powerful idea that in a way all of us live with some sort of leap of faith. No one has a certainty in an era devoid of, you know, this expiration of Parshas Truma, of a Mishkan, where you can literally point to a place and say, I see God's presence resting there. An era devoid of that. So then you're not really a heretic. Yes, it's wrong, and we hope you come back, and we hope you keep these strictures and every jot and tittle of halach, but we're not going to say, Dino Ka. And therefore, we have a place for you here. Mistaken, but you're maybe mistaken in your belief. You have a place for us in our community. And that's a very powerful thing. He ends off quoting the pasuk from Yeshayahu, from Hosea, also a Joey Newcomb song, that it's on us to bring them back with avosa sahava, with cords of love, rather than pushing people away, pulling back with cords of love. And to address the second question, he says, and therefore tochacha the same way, rebukes the same way. If rebuke is going to undermine what we want to accomplish, and he says, and no one in this generation really knows how to rebuke. If he quotes the Chafetz Chaim, says that, so then there's no obligation to rebuke as well. I saw actually, there was one Hasidic posik, I don't remember who it was, I saw this also a while ago, who said that there is an obligation to rebuke. We have to protest. We see Chilul Shabbos. He goes, you know how you protest in this generation? You protest by inviting them for your Shabbos and showing them the beauty of Shabbos and showing them the beauty of the life in which you're living. That's how you protest. And that, I would venture to say, the sentiment expressed in a tshuva like that is only because the Chaz Nish went before him and said, we don't really have real heretics nowadays. And the Binyan Tzion said, somebody's Mechal Shabbos isn't Ka'akum because they're not doing it just because they want to repudiate and reject and renounce God. They're doing it because they want to live this lifestyle. So that's the Chaz Nish. I said, we're running out of time. Let's get to the Rav. It's important, however, and again, I don't want to knock the Chaz Nish, his contribution is monumental here. Yet at the same time, there's two points to make. Number one is, there is discussion and debate exactly to how far the Chaz Nish was willing to go with the statement. Really, someone who grew up and went to yeshiva, who grew up in a beautiful, warm home environment, and they walk away, you're going to say they're Tinuk Shen Ishba? Come on. Really? Because they don't see God's divine providence? So some don't want to say that. Also, the Chaz Nish elsewhere seem to contradict it. But it seems to be the vast majority of poskim. And again, I think there may be an ideological a preference, if you will, depending where you are on the ideological spectrum. I guess I'd say probably more in the world we come from, the YU world, it's probably more embracive of the Chaz Nish. Elsewhere, maybe look at it a little more restrictively. But for the whole, most agree or take on this Chaz Nish as at face value that really we don't have divine providence, so we're not going to look at someone as. Yet, despite that, I want to point out the Chaz Nish still viewed the secular Jew as not as important, if you will, as almost second class. And I'll tell you what exactly. So in this mythical, in the mythology of that emerged from, again, the conversation took place, in the mythology that emerged between this famous conversation between David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, someone who himself learned the Cheder, by the way, Tinuk Shenish, but that whole was vehemently opposed to religion, and the Chaz Nish. A lot took place, but allegedly part of, and this part entered into the general, even legacy, lexicon of the standard Israeli, what took place was a part of the conversation. The Chaz Nish said to Ben-Gurion that when you have two carts that meet at an impasse, two wagons that meet at an impasse, they meet at an impasse. And some say it was placing donkeys, some say camels, okay, fine, different gear cells. But we'll use you have two carts that meet at an impasse. One cart is laden full with items, and the other one is empty. It's incumbent upon the empty one to give the full one the right of way, allow it to pass before it first. That was the mashal, the analogy he gave to Ben-Gurion, to which he then said, "We both are carts. We're brothers. But ultimately, those who are full of mitzvos and Torah and God, we come first. You have to give us the right of way because we're laden with mitzvos. That's who we are. And you," he said, "are an empty cart." Now, just I said, enter the lexicon, that's like a slur one could say in Israel, refer to the chilonim as an empty cart in Hebrew. Also, there was a book put out 2 years ago. It was a terrible book. Don't recommend it. Just sloppy research, poorly written, called The Empty Cart. It's basically an anti-Zionist, I don't even want to call it a diatribe against Zionism. But again, use this title, empty cart, to kind of say all those Zionists are members of the empty cart. They're pulling empty carts. Allegedly, Ben-Gurion responded to the Chaz Nish who basically said that you're second class, the Gaon responded, no, we too have a cart full of things. Just our cart is full of national service. And our cart is full of cultivating the land of Israel. Our cart is full of sacrificing for the land of Israel and the defense of Israel. Okay, so that's what took place. But what's important, that what I highlight from here, is the Chazal said, well, I created a space for you that you're not in Akum, and you're Tinuk Shenishba. You still are, you're not a Torah Jew. And again, no one's going to say you're a Torah Jew, but you're not, we don't have, you're behind us. You're second class. We have nothing to learn from you. You're an empty cart sitting there. Again, we're joined together. We have we're working together, but we don't really have what to gain or learn from you because we're full and you're empty. And this brings us to Rabbi Soloveitchik, which, and I believe Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I think really is fleshed out by Ron Lichtenstein, is an outgrowth in a way of Binyan Sion. Whereas the Binyan Sion sort of neutralizes the tension of Dinuk Akum, there are opening on Azara. Oh no, we can't eat their shchita. Oh no, we can't drink their wine. He neutralizes it, and therefore kind of left. Okay, so they're secular Jew. Rabbi Soloveitchik and then his son-in-law of Lichtenstein see an inherent goodliness and an inherent value in this, what otherwise would be a neutralized territory, in this idea of someone saying, I may be secular, but I'm still Jewish. I'm still making kiddush, etc. So I'll explain to you what I mean, right? The Rav, speech he gave, an address he gave in 1956, it was during the Suez Canal, it was during the Suez Canal crisis, one of the crises down on the southern border of Israel. He gave what became known, one of his more famous speeches, when it's written up, called Kol Dodi Dofik, which is borrowed from Shir Shirim, and it's that Shir Shirim is talking about how the beloved is laying in bed, and there's a knock on the door. The lovers come to the beloved. The beloved starts making excuses. I don't want to get out. It's too hot, cold outside. I'm nice and comfortable. I'm tired, etc. And by the time they get up and open the door, the lover has sprinted off, and then the beloved has to chase the lover. They never catch each other. And this is supposed to be an allegory to Klal Yisrael and God, and we love each other. We're kind of always missing each other, but we're always searching for one for the other. All right, it's a beautiful Shir Shirim that we know. Says the Rav in Kol Dodi Dofik, that this was given, it was an address he gave to Mizrahi. He says, when I look at the state of Israel, what I hear are six knocks, where God is knocking on our door and saying to us, I'm here. Here are these tremendous miracles, six tremendous miracles. Open the door and recognize. See what I see. See the miracles that are here. And the Rebbe is saying, I don't want to be the beloved laying in bed till too late and open the door and realize I missed the boat. The knocks are there, six knocks. And he talks about how they're the knocks of the miraculous military victory. He talks about the theological knock, how the state of Israel served to refute the replacement theology of the Catholic Church. That no longer can the Catholic Church say the Jews are only kept around by God to bear witness to what it means to be God's abandoned people. But now we're back in our state. He talks about the idea that Jewish blood isn't cheap. That no matter where you are in the world, you know. If you harm a Jew, you are now in the crosshairs of the Mossad, of the Israeli government. He talks about how no longer will we have full boats of refugees being turned away from closed ports, sent back to the fiery inferno of what was then the Holocaust, but now this a homeland for all the Jews. And then he goes on to discuss the idea of Tzadik Ralo and how good things happen to bad people, etc. And within all this, he puts forth the following thesis, which at first seems interesting, nice homiletical drush, if you will, but then you realize almost how radical it is based off what we developed tonight. He says, we the Jewish people, all of us, share two common risim, two covenants that we share with each other. And these two covenants actually became the title for the English translation of, since we have the covenant of fate and the covenant of destiny. He says our historical connection, what binds us historically, the fact we were all in the tribe because we were Jewish people, the fact that we were all persecuted because we were a race, the things that is and oftentimes the anti-Semitism reminding us of, that's the covenant of fate, that because we are born into the Jewish family, we have a shared fate. And then he says there's the covenant of destiny. That covenant was sealed at Har Sinai. Not one of, I'm stuck with this is who I am. Rather, it's us saying Nasiv and Nishma. It's something I want. It's a lifestyle I want to embrace. It's somewhere I want to go. I want to share a destiny, not just a history, but a destiny with you as well. And Rav Soloveitchik writes that whereas Jews who are Shomer Torah Mitzvos, Maminim, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu have a shared destiny, those, all Jews, religious not or non-religious, affiliated, non-affiliated, we have a shared fate, one that binds us together. And what the Rav is doing is he's carving out a space that gives not just a heter, a dispensation, for now we can collaborate, because you're not an opera. But he's saying that we have a shared brother, that we have a shared covenant together, one of fate. And that has tremendous significance. And then it's Rav Lichtenstein who really develops this. Rav Lichtenstein writes this in an article, one of his first published articles called Brother Daniel and the Limit of Jewish Fraternity. The article was written, this is actually, Rabbi Brand gave an entire series of shirim on this, I think 2 years ago, who was a Jew. What happened was that there was this Daniel, young Jewish boy who was hidden in a monastery during the war. And ultimately, not only does he stay in the monastery, but he comes out, he's a priest. After the war, and he grows up, he becomes a priest. And he then wants to make Aliyah and live in Israel as a priest, arguing that under the law of return, he has every right, because he has Jewish parents, and he himself was born a Jew, he has every right to return to Israel. And this creates a specific and very live debate about who's a Jew. And everyone's weighing in. And Rav Lichtenstein, in this article, he says something very similar to the Rav, and actually quotes the Rav. And he says as follows. That the very fact that you, someone, lives in the state of Israel and identifies with Knesset Israel, Jewish peoplehood, that has tremendous significance. And that the barometer, or not the barometer, but the barometer of who is in and who is out is not, do you have a shared destiny? Do you keep Torah mitzvos? But rather it is, do you or do you not identify with Knesset Yisrael, with the Jewish people on a whole? Amech Ami, as Ruth said to Naomi, your people are my people. Which creates this now a whole space for all these people who may totally reject the destiny, reject Torah mitzvos, reject God, but yet, they still have a shared Knesset Yisrael experience. They're members of the Jewish community as well. I suspect that what captivated the Rav Lichtenstein was the fact that he's living now in the state, a Jewish sovereign state being run by secular Jews who are doing everything in their power, dedicating and sacrificing their lives for their brothers and sisters to advance the Jewish cause. And what emerges from here is that Rav Lichtenstein now not just gives a het, a dispensation, not just says, oh, you know what? You're a Tinuk Shanishba, or like the Chaz Nish, where you're mistaken. But you know, we're going to allow you to live with among us. But he actually says there's an inherent value to being a member of Knesset Yisrael. And I want to be clear, Rav Lichtenstein was very hurt, and he was pained, and very much disagreed with the kafira and the heresy and the rejection of God and the rejection of halacha. Yet at the same time, he was able to be nuanced to also look at the secular Jew and to see that they have something inherent to contribute to society. Not just because we need society to function, so we need bankers and we need soldiers. But no, you have what to contribute, not just financially and militarily, but even from an ideological perspective, you have what to contribute. Your point of view, there's something there as a member of Knesset Yisrael that I value and I have what to learn from. And we don't have enough time now. Be part two. Rav Lichtenstein, criticizes Rav Kook and Rav Kook's approach to the secular Jew. It's daft at this point that he criticizes him with when he says to Rav Kook that too often Rav Kook, he felt, and again, I spoke to Rav Brand about this last week, and Rav Brand thinks that Rav Lichtenstein didn't necessarily appreciate or have a full understanding of Rav Kook's approach, where Rav Kook too often felt that we need the secular Jew to build a state. And actually, it's the secular Jew, it's through his secularism. He doesn't realize it, but he's actually advancing God's agenda. Religiously said, that's a little bit patronizing. Like, you don't realize what you're doing, but really you're doing the right thing. No, you're a sophisticated, intelligent person. And what it takes is to be nuanced, like a Lichtenstein, and all of us hope that on the one hand, we can look at a secular Jew and say, we wish and we hope that one day you can come back to Torah mitzvahs. And we wish and we hope that you have the correct beliefs. Yet at the same time, we also can value you, not just as a person, but for what you have to contribute because you're a member of Knesset Yisrael. That if you can die for this country, and you can sacrifice for this country, it's not just because you're a body that we need. but because you're an inherent, integral part of what it means to be a member of Klal Yisrael, and we value that. And that's what lichdut. To summarize where we're at, we opened up saying that it's so important to try to really figure out what the status of a Chiloni Jew is, because in the state of Israel, we're living together. It's not just another person, a random person on the street, but this is how the country's functioning, and this is who we're interacting with. And we saw three approaches. One that predated the state of Israel, the Binyan Zion, that said the reason that one who rejects Shabbos is considered an Achum is because they're repudiating and rejecting God. The Binyan Zion said, they look around. As Shmuel Feinerman says, most people are pseudo-enlightened Jews. They don't actually believe it. They just want the opportunity to engage in whatever it is, whatever freedoms they can now access. The Chaz Nish said that in a world devoid of explicit divine intervention, so that no one's really considered kofar, you're not rejecting something, you're just embracing a secular lifestyle. Yet we also saw that he still felt that there was nothing to learn or gain from a secular Jew. You can gain practically and pragmatically, but not inherently. And there are Lichtenstein and the Rav, we talked about the bris of fate, the covenant of fate, which binds when you're a member of Knesset Yisrael, you're able to contribute in a meaningful way. And yes, while we still are pain, and it's wrong the way in which you may live your life, but at the same time, there's also much to laud about it, much to learn again. So I wish you all a wonderful night, and I'm open for any questions or comments or thoughts.